Atheist Nomads, episode 366. Everyone's Autonomous with Marie Delafont.
The podcast you're about to listen to includes cursing and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. In a little bit, I'll be joined by Marie Delafont. But before that, I need to talk about something I saw in the news. A study has been published looking at why people refuse to wear masks and neglect social distancing here in 2020 in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. And what the researchers, the lead researcher being Samuel Perry, whose Twitter handle is SOC of the Sacred, who's a associate professor at the University of Oklahoma, and his co-authors, Andrew Whitehead and Joshua Grubbs, found and published in the Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion. So between his Twitter handle and the journal, you might be able to make a few assumptions about them. They found that there was a direct inverse relationship between adherence to Christian nationalist ideology and adherence to public health recommendations on mitigating the pandemic. This was across a survey results from more than 2,500 people, 2,519 to be exact. And what they found was that Christian nationalists believe that America is the new Israel, that it's God's, you know, Americans are God's chosen people, and that anything bad that happens to America is because God is punishing us for sin. So the solution is to be more pure. Pure, in a Christian nationalist sense, would include being extra patriotic, as well as trying to be a better Christian. So, you know, hating the gays and whatnot. They believe that purity is what will protect them, specifically what will get them God's protection from the virus that he is using to punish sinful people. That is what will protect them from COVID-19. Purity. Not masks, not distancing. Purity. So, we've talked about it plenty with pundits that have made these claims and pastors that have made these claims. So, we know where this is coming from. Where it gets a little more frustrating is by the end of the interview, they say that, oh, this isn't a religion thing, this is a Christian nationalist thing. And that once they controlled for Christian nationalism, they found that religiosity directly correlated with how much people followed the public health guidance. So take all of the Christians. So about 65% of the U.S. population, and subtract out all the Christian nationalists, and you see they follow the rules just fine. Okay, well, we already know from other studies that have been done that Christian nationalism also is the single number one indicator of whether or not somebody supports Donald Trump. And we know that there's about 35% of the population that will follow Trump to the ends of the earth. If we were to take this to its logical conclusion, that would suggest that roughly 35% of Americans are Christian nationalists. And if 35% of Americans are Christian nationalists, that would be a slight majority of Christians in this country. making a claim that if you control for that one thing, everything looks better is kind of disingenuous when you're removing a majority of the sample you're looking at. It would be like trying to make the claim that once you control for small-breasted women, all blonde women have large boobs. You can manipulate data to get a result that you want, and they manipulated the data to make it not look like this was a religion problem. When if it's even remotely possible that a majority of Christians are the problem, trying to say that the most devout ones, as long as you ignore all of these very devout people, aren't part of the problem. No, it absolutely is the problem. The fact that we live in a country where roughly half of Christians not only ignore science and evidence, but actively fight against it, is the problem. They are the ones who tend to be the most active, the most likely to vote, and the most vocal. The moderate Christians out there, your typical Methodist or Episcopalian or Catholic, keep their mouths shut and don't make a big deal about it. They don't have their own TV shows to promote being a good, reasonable person, yet religious. And they don't put pundits on Fox News to promote being good, reasonable people, yet religious. It's the idiotic assholes who go on Fox News and who have their own TV channels. We can hope that the numbers aren't as bad as I'm interpreting them to be. And we also know that Christian nationalism also tends to be white nationalism. And 35% of the country being rabid racists. I'm sure if we were to talk to any person of color, they would confirm that that's reasonable or a conservative estimate. The numbers are all moving in the right direction. But 35% is still a lot. And yeah, they are likely, more likely than the people who are following the rules, to die of COVID-19. But they are still less likely than people of color who have a tendency to be working in essential jobs that have direct contact with angry asshole customers who refuse to wear masks. Wearing a mask to the grocery store will likely make no difference to you as a customer in your safety. Every customer wearing a mask does improve the safety of the cashier. But they don't care because that's poor people and that's black people and Latinos and other people that they view as lesser. And that's a problem. And if that ends up tying in with avoiding a vaccine, assuming a good vaccine can even be developed, and I want to make sure it's clear that, yes, there is a lot of good progress going on in developing vaccines. But humanity has never developed a vaccine for a coronavirus before. Yeah, we have vaccines for other viruses. We've never done one for a coronavirus. And there's growing evidence that people can catch COVID-19 more than once. And if you can catch the same virus more than once, odds of vaccines being effective are a lot lower. Containment may actually be our best and only chance to beating this pandemic and avoiding this virus becoming a normal part of the common cold. just a common cold that kills and disables people. Taking it seriously is important, and if we've got as much as 35% of the country actively fighting the recommendations because they believe the issue is sin, then we're fucked. And on that note, we're going to move on to the interview. We are now joined by Marie Delafont of the Everyone's Autonomous podcast. Marie, welcome to Atheist Nomads.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So first off, let's start off with, what is your podcast?
Well, like you mentioned, it's called Everyone's Autonomous. And it's a little spinoff of a show that was on the air for 5 years called Everyone's Agnostic, hosted by Cass Midgley and Bob Pondillo. I took over for the last year as a co-host when Bob left. And then Cass decided to kind of end things, but I wasn't done. So I just kind of made a little stepchild of Everyone's Autonomous, which continues our dialogues on people recovering from religion. But it also strives to go a little bit further and then say, so now what? So now what does this mean about our humanity and everyone else's to be on this earth? And so we tend to go into discussions about social justice or any kind of other like equality seeking endeavors. Any way to get everyone on earth to live as well as they possibly can, and the barriers that might be in the way of that.
Okay, very nice. And that is a logical first step. And you know, like when Cass was on Atheist Nomads, we talked about that and how his, you know, he acknowledged that Everyone's Agnostic was meant to be like a training wheels podcast to help people on those first steps of that journey, having the next steps available as the follow up to that is sounds nice.
Yeah, that's kind of how I see it. And I definitely don't want to rush anyone. I don't think that recovery from religion can be just skipped or hurried through. And so hopefully people will still find a lot of themselves in podcasts like Everyone's Agnostic, and perhaps still mine too. But mine is always going to be trying to push people a little bit, just a little bit more forward, and using our experiences having left religion to understand the experiences of the other that we're coming into contact now too, and try to expand our mind to see different experiences that we don't personally relate to, and then to advocate for those lives.
All right. Very nice. You have a interesting background too.
I do. I don't know which part you're talking about, but yeah.
So you grew up religious.
Yeah.
What flavor of religious was that?
Started in Lutheranism and then into like the Northern white people Baptist kind of thing.
Okay. So full on evangelical.
Yes, that's probably the best word. Yeah.
And then From your description of it in your email to me, it sounds like you took that to its logical extreme pretty quickly.
I was smart, right? So they present this stuff to you and you're really serious about it, then what are you going to do? You're going to become a missionary. You're going to go, it doesn't matter where, you're going to go and you're going to tell people, as many people as possible. If you had the cure to cancer, would you just keep hanging out with a bunch of other people who had the cure to cancer every Sunday? Or would you go and put yourself in vulnerable positions in order to pass that around? And I truly believe that I had the cure. And so I feel good about that in the sense that I had a lot of integrity in terms of like, if this is what is true, then I'm going to really do this. And so, yeah, I did. I became a missionary in the summers during high school, and then full time after I graduated from high school for about 2 years.
Oh, wow. And where do you go?
It's a city called Culiacan in Mexico. It's in the central Mexico west coast, so sort of by Mazatlan, if people know where Mazatlan is.
Okay. So you tried to find the nearby brown heathens and convert them to very, very white Christianity.
Yeah, you're not wrong. And to be fair, I've been very like enamored by Latino culture since probably my sophomore year of high school. And I took 4 years of Spanish in high school, and the missions work that I did locally before I graduated high school was with Latino communities. And so it just made a lot of sense to me to go to Mexico, but I like your way of putting it too.
Well, everybody who you talk to, anybody who went on a mission trip as a teenager, 9 out of 10, or probably 99 out of 100, went to Mexico.
Yeah.
It's close. It's cheap to get to. Most of the people there and the cities where people go to be missionaries speak at least some English.
Yeah.
And it's just easy to travel to if you're an American.
Yeah. Especially if you are the type of evangelical Christianity that espouses underneath itself almost a type of colonialism, like that's why I laugh and don't think you're wrong at all that these were the nearest people of color I could find. And so if you're looking down on other cultures with that lens, then and you're lazy, that's the closest country you could go to.
Catholic majority, they don't speak English, they
yeah
have darker skin than us, and
and they're the drugs that, yeah, I think I still have, actually, now that we're talking about it, I think I still have a lot to unpack around the impressions of Mexico that I built up during my time down there, as well as impressions of Mexico that I was educated with, just being someone who was educated in this system. Mm-hmm. And I think that I'm just sitting here just with some awareness being like, oh shit, I think that's an unexplored area of white supremacy and Christian supremacy that I have yet to kind of dig into, but I can sense that it's there.
Yeah. Well, it's like one that I found out recently, relatively recently, was that in the Mexican-American War, most European countries were betting on Mexico winning.
Really?
Yeah. They were the more stable country at that point.
Is that right?
Huh. And they adopted an almost identical system to the U.S. politically and did not make that work. And if you look across Latin America, most of the countries in Latin America adopted an American-style Republican government.
Huh.
And they all ended in military dictatorships. It's not that we're the exception, it's we're the anomaly.
Or that we're on our way.
Or that we just haven't gotten there yet.
We're just still working our way there.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens after November.
Yeah. But, you know, there was a good reason why the, you know, George Washington and friends were not trustful of a large standing army. You have people with guns, they can get rid of the people who don't.
Yeah. Yeah. This country has a lot of history that I wasn't aware of, and I'm learning stuff like that, too.
But with going to Mexico, yeah. Okay, I did two mission trips to Mexico.
Did you? Okay.
Both, ironically, were to Cancun. One was in high school, and the second was preaching an evangelistic series as a seminary student.
Okay.
And that's when I quit the church, because I didn't actually believe it by that point. So I quit, and if you're going to leave religion in anywhere, Cancun's a great place to do it.
So you quit actively while you were in Cancun?
Yeah. Yep.
That's cool.
Yeah. I couldn't keep preaching stuff I didn't believe.
Yeah.
And but so you were there, like your summers, was that like full summer trips or just like 2 week trips during the summer?
This missions, you mean the summers of high school?
Yeah.
Or the summers during high school? There was, I think, 3 summers in total over my high school career that I spent at a Bible camp. Working full time as staff on there. And then one of those summers I spent in a town up north from here, a very blue collar small town, very mixed demographic, a lot of Croatians for some reason, Bosnians, Mexicans. There's a turkey factory there. Anyway, I worked in that small town for the entire summer supporting the church really being useless and a drain on their resources when I look back now.
You were a high school student. Of course you were useless.
I know. Yeah. I was unmotivated. I don't know how to unpack that quite, because clearly I gave up my whole summer to go and live in this town. So it wasn't that I was unmotivated, but once I was there, I felt disillusioned and depressed and useless and wandering. And so I just kind of like laid in my bed a lot and thought about Jesus and whether this was real. And that took me a while.
Yeah. And so then, okay, so you did summers that way. That's a very common approach for devout Christian kids to do.
Yep.
And then when you went to Mexico for 2 years, was that fresh, like right out of high school?
Yeah. Cause I graduated high school in 2000 and I went to a Lutheran high school that could be seen as more evangelical than Lutheran. Lutheran feels like a very bland mayo flavor, but this was a lot more evangelical, charismatic flavor. When I was graduating, like we talked about, the logical conclusion of these beliefs leading you to certain decisions. I was graduating and I was like, could not understand why my peers were choosing to go to college. I was like, have you not been listening to these chapels? And that people are dying and going to hell all the time and that we need to save them. Like, what? How could you be so self-indulgent? And I was incredibly silently judgmental of all of my classmates and resented their self-righteous, like, I got a scholarship to blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, good for you. Like, I don't care. You know, so there was a, I don't know if it was anti-intellectualism, but I had my values and I judged people who did not live by those values.
Okay.
So, I mean, that was part of it. And then the other part was that, I really struggled with my sense of self and my self-esteem, at that age. I still do, but it's getting better. But I really didn't think I was very smart at all. Like I remember people warning us in junior high about like, oh, just you wait to go to you until you go to high school, then it's gonna be really hard. And I was like, oh god. And then I get to high school and I'm like, oh yeah, this is kind of hard, but it's not as bad as they said. But then in high school they'll be like, oh, just you wait until you get in college, that's gonna be really fucking hard. And then I really took that personally, and I struggled in high school because I have a very different way of learning things that is not addressed in our system, on our educational system. So I had to figure it out myself and make my own adaptations. So I really didn't think that I would do well in college. And again, like I mentioned earlier, I didn't see the point spiritually speaking. And so I just decided not to. And I was in the middle of yet another faith crisis, because most of my life up until my mid 20s was at a constant faith crisis. Like, I think I underestimate how incredibly traumatic that entire time span was. And the more I get healed up from it and get really grounded into myself, the more I realize like how fucked up that whole thing really, really was. And which is funny, because as time goes by, you expect to feel like a little bit lighter about it. Like, time heals all wounds, or time educates you and makes you real pissed off that you got the goddamn wounds in the first fucking place.
Yeah.
So there's some complexity there, but yeah. So I didn't go to college. When I graduated later, I did end up going to college in 2005 for my undergrad. And it's kind of funny because I did amazing in college. It wasn't super hard for me because I found my stride and I figured out how to manage my learning ability. And, I did really well. But the funny thing is, throughout those 4 years, I kept on hearing, oh, just you wait till grad school. That's going to be really fucking hard. And everyone's always talking about that. And only recently have I started to question that narrative too. I'm like, do I really believe that? Do I really believe that that's so fucking hard that I'm just not going to do it because everyone else is bitching and moaning about it? Or am I capable as fuck and could kill it at grad school because I believe in myself? So I've been kind of wondering about going back to school lately. But that was a long answer to your short question. Yeah. But that's my relationship with education.
Okay. And then, so when you went to Mexico, what did you do?
Well,
because 2 years is a long time.
It is. So they function on a semester schedule. So that helps you frame it up there. Similar, you know, analogous to regular schools.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, first thing, so the missionary school is called Youth with a Mission, YWAM. And they have what they call bases located all over this green earth and blue earth, this pale blue dot. And so you YWAM bases create missionaries through their DTS schools, which stands for Discipleship Training School. So you go and you sign up for a semester, it's 6 months. You get credits that are transferable to the University of Nations, which is a YWAM college in Hawaii. those credits do not transfer to actual legitimate educational institutions, FYI. So I did that. That was those first 6 months that I did their schooling. And the first 3 months of that schooling is, it almost makes me want to kind of vomit to say the word, but theory. Mm-hmm. They taught you the theory. Basically, they indoctrinated you for 3 months. You go to lecture every day, 5 days a week for about 3 hours. You have tests that you do. And then in the afternoons, they drag you to some, you know, impoverished area of Mexico, and you perform, you know, dances, puppetry, you sing, you, sometimes we would offer actual humanitarian services, but rarely. We would preach. We'd, you know, bring a microphone and a speaker along with us, and we would go and invite everyone in the neighborhood to come to our performance. And a lot of people would come because a bunch of white people just came to your door and said, "Hey, we're going to dance for you." And you're like, "This should be interesting." So they go and they watch us. And so we'll perform, and students get their chance to share their testimony. And so these insecure 18-year-olds are sharing about how they were raised Christian in America and felt like they were sinful. And so then they believed in Jesus, and now their life has been better. And that's supposed to mean something to these impoverished folks of Mexico.
Oh, man. I heard so many of those testimonies in college of the...
Did you?
Yeah. Went and partied for like months and then found Jesus again. And like, there was one guy who was one of the most popular in college. He smoked pot, did cocaine, and shot up heroin for 2 years after high school, and then came back to Jesus and wanted to be a pastor. But most of them were made that look. Well, most of them were basically, you smoked pot once and you felt bad about it, or you watched porn a couple times and felt bad about it. And yeah.
And I like that you bring that up, because I'm deconstructing a lot of narratives around drugs too. And so what you've just said kind of reminded me of how the narratives of drugs were intertwined with Christianity. And like, that was always part of the testimony. It was like, "Oh yeah, I used to smoke pot, or I had sex one time." And like, it's supposed to be this testimony of like, "Oh, I was such a rebel. I was such a badass, but now I believe in Jesus and I make casserole." And so the stories are absurd looking back, because I haven't thought of these stories. You just reminded me of what they were actually about and what they were saying. And now, sitting here being someone who smokes pot on the reg and is very much interested in trying more psychedelics, and very much feels like if there was any Jesus to be found, it would be through psilocybin. Like, I think drugs are God. They're as close to God as I think we're ever going to get. And here we were telling stories about how it was taking us away from God. I just watched a show on Netflix, Psychedelics with Hamilton. I don't remember his full name, but it's this really nerdy, awesome guy who does psychedelics all over the place. And he went down to Oaxaca, Mexico, and worked with some Christians down there and did psilocybin as a part of their Christian Those Christians do shrooms for Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, of course they do. Like, that makes so much more sense than not doing shrooms for Jesus. Like, they really think God is there. Like, I've never had more of a quote unquote spiritual experience than when I do pot, and I still know that it's not Jesus.
Yeah.
But like, that's where the real experiences of spirituality are, in my opinion.
Well, when I was in Cancun, after I quit preaching, I had this would have been, I think, my fourth day after quitting Christianity. I went snorkeling with three French girls.
That's so random.
Yeah. I met two of them on the beach the day before, and they weren't wanting to do a random tour and thought I seemed like a harmless, super naive guy. So they invited me to join them on their boat and had another friend with them. And yeah, so I went snorkeling on a privately chartered boat with three French girls.
That sounds lovely.
It was awesome. And then I hopped a ferry to Cozumel, and the ferry ticket came with a free snorkeling trip that day. So I went snorkeling again. That boat had free beer, so I started drinking, and I like chugged down three beers on the boat, got off the boat and wandered into some of the shops, and they were pouring shots of tequila in the shops.
Oh my God.
And so in like 30 minutes time, I chugged three beers and three shots of tequila, bought some knockoff Cuban cigars, and after about four puffs of the cigar, I had to sit down. And I had this feeling rush over me that tripped some major deja vu, and I had to think about it, and it was like, this feels kind of like a really intense spiritual experience.
Yeah.
It was the exact same pathways getting triggered.
Yep. Yeah, I think you're totally right. I think that, and this is something I've been discussing a lot in the last couple of weeks, the appropriation of whatever we want. I know that former religious people using a word like spiritual can be a little bit triggering. So mm-hmm. I'm very, very intentional when I use the word spiritual that I don't mean anything otherworldly. It's just, for me, I think it's more of a connection of your subconscious with your conscious with your unconscious. And that can feel really spiritual because like all those blocks protecting you and narratives that are driving you are released and you finally feel some clarity. And that's what spirituality is. But God, what was I going to even say with that? But the appropriation of that connection, and you can attain that connection through multiple paths. You mm-hmm. can obtain it through worship, you know, praise and worship music can trigger that sense of connectedness and clarity of mind, or just a sense of peace. Meditation can do that. Getting a massage, doing cannabis, doing shrooms, having a long, deep-hearted conversation with someone. Mm-hmm. Those are all experiences that we actively participate in, and feelings that our body provides to us.
Yeah.
That is purely within the unit of our APE body. And so when these religions come around and say, no, it's this external thing that I happen to know very well that's producing this feeling within you, and now you need to follow me and do what I say and follow all these rules, and then they appropriate your quote unquote spirituality, your ability to naturally connect mm-hmm. with yourself and to heal. Again, the word heal is kind of gross, but to heal yourself through better living with chemicals. And that pisses me off. And I can tell, like, yeah, you figured that out on day four.
Yeah. And it was just, you know, if you look at history, the relationship between mind altering substances and religion is absolute until like the Second Great Awakening. Mm-hmm. It's a very recent occurrence for that to come with teetotaling.
Uh-huh.
And like, with the exception of Islam. Islam's just a little bit weird in that regard. But like, you look at like traditionally, Christianity has every religious gathering involved drinking wine. And it wasn't the modern, a little sip from a cup. It would be, you'd be drinking a lot of wine during the service. And they've recently found some at an archaeological site in Israel. It was a shrine of some place, of some sort, with cannabis residue in it.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah. So it happens. It's been happening for a long time.
Yeah.
It's just this recent not doing that. And of course, people got bored with it. So the modern praise music, praise service mindset and charismatic Christianity both have the goal of creating that same, you know, trying triggering that same kind of mental pathways.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because in the end, these are experiences in religion, even teetotaling religion, they were very sensational.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember going to churches in Mexico and like we'd be praying for miracles and stuff. And like, then the electricity would go out and then we'd be screaming against demons because we figured the demons were there and trying to do something, where if you took a deep breath and you just looked around in the room, you would notice that there was a man in the back corner who was resolving the issue with the electricity and then solved it. But the room was in a hypnotic state.
Yeah.
That they interpreted it how they wanted to interpret it. And there are some people who are just going to be there and be like, okay, a crazy crowd wants to think crazy, so I'm just going to let them. But yeah, we read into everything.
Yeah, was that at the Lutheran church or the Baptist church?
This is in mission school.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the missions work that I did was beyond anything I had ever experienced in Minnesota. Like, beyond. It was crazy. We were praying for a child to be resurrected after he was killed by a bank table in an ATM room outside of a bank, falling on him as he was climbing on it because it wasn't bolted into the ground. We prayed for his resurrection when he was in the hospital, when he was declared dead, and at his funeral, when he had already been, like, I don't know what the word is for when they prepare the embalmed body. Yeah, he had already been embalmed. We were still praying. I don't know how he would come back to life if he's filled with all that shit.
Oh, but wow.
That doesn't matter. It doesn't matter when there's this God. Anything is possible.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Okay, so you were there 2 years.
Yeah.
Was that all at that school?
Yeah. Well, no, I guess not. I studied there for a semester. I came back as staff for the following semester. However,
wait. After a semester, you're staff.
That's correct. They let 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds basically run these things.
Oh, wow. No wonder it's so radical.
Yeah. It's that kind of Christianity that believes that it doesn't matter what your education is or anything, that everyone can connect to God, and so everyone has a legitimate truth. And so if you tell someone that Jesus told you to do something, you just let them do it, because they clearly Jesus did, and you just trusted that, and that created an environment rife for abuse.
Yeah.
So yeah, I did the, and when I say semester, now I'm realizing that I was saying that incorrectly, because a semester is like 3-4 months, but I meant semester is more of a school year. So I did a school year from September to March, and that was my student time span. So I was misremembering that, but
that's still not long.
No, it's not long. There was no actual training. It was just indoctrination, a bunch of things that do not connect to actually draw anything that makes any kind of sense. If you think about those kid games where you're supposed to draw the numbers together and it's supposed to create an object, in the end, it just was a bunch of scribbling. But regardless, I felt galvanized by my experiences down there, because they were much more sensational and charismatic than anything that I had experienced in white evangelical culture. So, and I continued to have doubts. I thought that being in mission school would fix it, especially this particular mission school, considering how charismatic it was, but it didn't fix it. And so I decided to come back because, again, I still felt like missions was probably the most important job you could ever do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came back the next semester to be staff, and that was in 2001. In August of 2001, I was in India for my older sister's wedding. She got married to an Indian man, and so we went over there for the wedding. The night before we were going to come home, we were told that our country had been attacked. That was 9/11.
You were in India.
Yeah, I experienced it at night. Everyone else here talks about the morning. I was in India, a day after her wedding, and the electricity was gone. And so somebody just had been watching TV off of a generator and came out and said, your towers have been attacked. And so we spent the next day just glued to the TV and watching. Our flights were canceled. Eventually, we were able to leave India, but we only got as far as UK. And then we were stuck in UK for 5 days while the flights were down. Mm-hmm. But anyway, my point with that story is that it was during that time again that I had yet another faith crisis.
My daughter just got her first face mask.
Oh, cute!
They have finally, like, the guidance has pretty solidly settled on no masks under two, but have been going kind of back and forth on what to do with 2-year-olds.
Sure.
So now she has one.
Aww. Does it have a design on it?
It's pink.
Oh, cute. Oh, nice. Oh, that looks lovely. And I like your dress, too.
She can't hear you.
She can't hear me? No. Oh, okay. Well, I still like her dress. It's very cute.
Okay, so eventually you did get back to the U.S.
Yes.
And then
went
back to the missionary school.
Right. But I was having a faith crisis at the time, and then put on top of that a national trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a very difficult place. And by the time my flight was ready to go back to Mexico, like, I'd already booked the flight and everything, I didn't believe in God anymore.
Oh, wow.
Again, because, like I said, my childhood was a roller coaster of faith crises.
Mm-hmm.
And then doing missions work to compensate for my doubts. So I wondered whether I should go or not. And I did end up going, because I decided that if I could find God, if there was any hope that God was real, he would be in Mexico at this school.
Yep.
Yeah.
That sounds kind of like my trip to Cancun after a 6-week6-week archaeological dig in Jordan. They were back-to-back trips. And by the time I got to Cancun, I was not quite an atheist, but definitely not a Christian. And I thought that was my last attempt to try to salvage some semblance of faith.
Yes, that's exactly how I felt too. But there was this very deep trauma and like terror to it. I was like, dear God, I hope I can grab some air before I drown here. I really felt like I was drowning. It didn't feel like a liberation or an experiment. It was really scary. So I did go down there and I did tell them, I told the leader of that school, that I was having a faith crisis, that I'm not sure I believe in God and I don't know if I should be here. I was trying to be ethical by communicating that to him as staff. I was like, I'm staff here, but I don't think I believe in God. Do you want me to go? And he said, no, I want you to stay. If you want to stay, I want you to stay. And he said the same thing. He said, if you're going to connect with God, you're going to find him here. And so he invited me to continue to stay knowing that. And looking back, I 100% think that he wanted me to stay because I was an asset.
Mm-hmm.
I'm bilingual. And so they need people to translate the speakers, whether the speaker speaks English, you can translate to Spanish or the Spanish speaker to English. So I would stand in front of the classes for like 3 hours every day and just do live translations. And to lose a translator at a school like that is a huge, huge loss. And I had a lot of other assets as well. Like, I ended up leading one of the outreach teams. I think I began to talk about it earlier, but those first 3 months are theory, and then the last 3 months are outreach. You go and you travel to another country or perhaps to Mexico itself, and it's no more classes anymore. It's just all street evangelism. And so that year that I was an atheist, I led one of those teams. And I was very essential for that. And so I think that's why they had me stay on regardless of my faith. So, that was the first year that I was staff. And then I came back, or rather, this is getting very overly detailed now, I'm thinking, but no, it's okay. It's okay. I just feel like a lot of these things are more boring details than actually essential details, but, I'll try to suffice it to say I got involved with another group of people through that school who wanted to start a school in Mexicali, which is a city on the border, kind of near San Diego, east of Tijuana. So I stayed with them the summer afterwards. It was just Spanish only, Mexicans only, except for me. And then we all went back to the school down in Culiacan together. And so I spent another semester down there as staff. And then I said to myself, I want to live in Mexicali. We're going to start a base there together, a YWAM base. We're going to be on the ground floor. Like, this is going to be amazing. And also that guy that I work with is really cute. And there's like maybe a chance that we could date would be nice. So I was very driven by boys at the time, but would never admit it. And in the end, the funny thing is the reason I left missions is because this boy I mentioned started dating someone. And I got really depressed and I didn't feel any desire to stay there anymore. Yeah. There was nothing enticing about it anymore. playing this non-sexual house, like missionary house game with this guy was really fun for me. And, but I got depressed once he started dating. And then since I couldn't admit that to myself, I decided that God was telling me that all of my choices up until now had been made without his consultation and that I shouldn't even be here.
Oh, wow.
So
that's quite,
yeah,
great.
It was a big cop out for sure. So I just, my parents offered to fly me home, but I was so disillusioned and depressed that I took the Greyhound and all 48 hours home, which I needed. I just needed to be really depressed.
Mexicali to Minnesota. That's a long one.
It was a long trip for sure. And scary at times, to be honest, but yeah, so I got back and I got my first job, like corporate job, as a bilingual call center agent. And with that opportunity, I went to Texas to get trained for the job, along with a large group of folks from Delhi, India, who were basically taking all of that department and outsourcing it over to India. So we were all hanging out together in this long-term hotel, getting trained on this job by people who were about to be laid off. It was very awkward.
Oh, wow.
But I took up with one of those Indians, and like, he was the first guy that I ever kissed. He's the first guy that I ever had sex with. And I was a mess from leaving religion, or I hadn't fully left religion then, but I was starting to feel really disillusioned and wasn't really interested in continuing to drown myself in Kool-Aid. So I took up with this guy at a very fragile point in my life and got married to him shortly thereafter. We only had the summer to hang out before he had to go back to India. And we were like, dude, this is really cool what we have. Like, what are we going to do about this? Like, am I going to just go to India so I can date you? Like, how does this even work? And so we're like, well, you know what? I think we get along well enough. Like, I feel like this is it's a risk, but I think it's a pretty measured risk to think that this should, you know, I think this will be okay. It'll work out. So like, based on that. Yeah. Yep.
Oh, wow.
So we got engaged. I bought my own wedding ring from a JCPenney that was being liquidated. And then I bought a ticket and flew over there in March because I met him in the summer. And so in March, I flew over there and got married to him in India. And I had to stay there for 3 months due to processes that we had to go through in order to get him to the green card through the embassy. So we had to go through an application. It goes faster if you can apply at the embassy in India in person. And so we had to sit at a desk and convince a man that we were in love with each other and show him emails and pictures and show that we knew each other's birthdays and favorite colors and stuff. So we convinced them. And which we were in love. And
well, they get,
anyway, yeah,
they get scammed a lot by
they do
rich.
It's fair.
Rich people paying desperate women lots of money.
They do. That is absolutely a thing. And we were aware of that. And I think I wasn't terribly resentful because of that. I knew that was a thing, but it was a barrier for sure.
Did you get asked about toothpaste?
I don't think so. Is that a thing?
The person I know who was in a green card marriage, who they got in trouble with, well, were under investigation to determine if it was a legit relationship. They lived in different counties.
Oh.
So eventually they moved into the same house because they'd started asking questions of each of them, like, what brand toothpaste do you use? Really mundane things that if you actually lived together, you would know the answer to. But
yep.
And they just
interesting.
Each, and if you get a different answer from each person, then, well, there's probably something fishy going on.
Yeah, no, that's a good question to ask. I don't super remember everything that they asked us. I just remember it being a lot easier than I thought it would be. Because all I had to do was speak honestly. Because, like I said, we were sincerely in love, and this is really what we wanted to do. But it was very awkward, though, to try to have to prove that to someone. But interesting, yeah. And I mean, so he and I were together for 5 years. We in that time, I was kind of softly deconverting. But not really talking about it because our relationship began to be pretty dysfunctional and unsatisfying, unfulfilling, frustrating. And that's like a story that the detail isn't as much relevant to anything we're talking about. I'm open about it, but it's just not super relevant. But it's just very unhealthy, codependent, and some controlling behaviors on both ends, I suppose. But then eventually we divorced. And around that time, I was really kind of anchoring into, you know, I think I'm atheist. And that was scary to say out loud. And especially given how much time I spent in my childhood wavering back and forth and being ashamed of not believing in God. And the fact that everyone I knew was Christian. Yeah. And I had just lost my partner who I thought I was going to be married with until I died. And so my whole life had just disappeared in front of me. My whole future, what I had built up.
Several times by that point.
Yeah, good point. Good point.
Like, you had a relatively normal teenage life in Minnesota. Then did missions, which is a completely different life. Then left that. Then married an Indian man. And then that ended. And it's like, you could not have had vastly different lives through each of those.
I like growing.
That just, oh yeah, that's just
yeah, that I mean, I think that's something about me. Well, I mean, it is what it is. Like, I think a lot of that is just driven by who I am, and I don't know how to control that. It just is what it is. But in the end, I like the arc.
Yeah.
I like the arc very much. I like where it's going for sure. And so that's what makes me trust me and the way that I develop my life on average. And so, yeah, so in 2010 now is, you know, when I left my ex and started dating other people, had sex outside of, well, to be fair, I had sex with my ex-husband too, but like had like more casual, like, no, I don't feel like I need to marry you sex with someone. And that was nice, very nice. And I took up with the guy that I live with now, pretty shortly after, and he and I have been together this whole time, and he's been good for me, especially near the beginning, because, you know, this is something I like to talk about, that a lot of us think that the hardest part of all of this is leaving religion. I personally have felt like the hardest part of this was the recovery thereafter, which is never a definitive, like, give yourself a couple of years and you'll be fine. It's in my blood now. The trauma that I experienced and the messages that I received are in my blood, and I can't take it out of me. And so as I grow as a person, as I get older, it's constantly showing up in new ways based on the new ways I'm seeing the world. But that journey had to start somewhere. That recovery had to start somewhere. So, you know, probably 2014 or 2015 is, you know, I had been in my relationship with my partner, who I'm technically married to, but I don't really care about marriage at this point. But I had been in a relationship with him for long enough to feel like, dear God, I finally have someone in my life who accepts me for who I am, mm-hmm. regardless of whether I believe in God or not, regardless of whether I cooked him a meal or not, which is like what the ex was like. So this was the first person I experienced loving me unconditionally, something that I couldn't provide to myself, something my family nor my church could provide to me. And so I just kind of hung out in a safe space with him for a while and let him kind of rescue me. And I don't regret that. That is a necessary thing that happened. And we've evolved way past that. He knows if he tried to rescue me, I would slap him in the face. Now we're much more independent now, and I'm happy about that. But in 2014, after feeling safe for a while, I was like, you know what? I have some serious issues around religion that I really would like to fucking deal with. And I had a hard time finding resources at that time. Mm-hmm. I really think that these last few years, resources for people recovering from religion has really boomed. Like, all you have to do is Google it and find, you know, recovering from religion. Yeah. And then they point you to like a bunch of other different resources. And so it's just amazing what's out there for people now. Like, they can see themselves pretty much anywhere they look. They'll be able to see themselves mm-hmm. in someone else who's putting content out there, like what you're doing too.
Yeah.
So then I began to look for those resources. They were hard to find. I came across Ryan Bell's podcast, Life After God. He's a Jehovah, or no, what was he?
He was former Seventh Adventist.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. He was Seventh Adventist.
Seventh Day.
It's all the same. They all look the same.
And
it's the S and the D are capital. The S and the A are capitalized. The D for day is not capitalized, and there's a hyphen between seventh and day.
Interesting.
People get that wrong all the time, and it's a pet.
Oh, I'm sure I'll always get it. Yeah. Okay. Well, he was from that.
Yeah.
And he decided to take a year off from God, and he wrote about it. And at the end of that year, he decided to stay away from God. He just didn't feel like there was a God, and so. He did a podcast and he talked about things, and he was the first atheist that I came across who was talking about things with nuance instead mm-hmm. of vitriol. Cause there's a lot of, and I see it mostly in atheists who have been atheists all of their lives, just a lot of vitriol, you know, towards people who believe. And I was really looking for some nuance and some discussion and some compassion and some emotional intelligence around the themes. Looking to grow, and instead of lighting things on fire, or maybe we can light things on fire too. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, but, so I found a lot of safety in that. And I had the pleasure of meeting him last year and telling him all of that to his face, which was a huge pleasure to convey that in person. Nice. Yeah. And so it was through his podcast that I came to find Cass Midgley, because Ryan interviewed him. And I don't know what it was about Cass that I liked, but I went and I listened to his podcast, Everyone's Agnostic, and I really enjoyed it too. There's a lot more themes of philosophy. Cass does a lot of active listening and helping to synergize parts of the story to kind of make sense of things and distill it down, which I found very healing.
Okay, so yeah, that bumper, the interview is not done. It's just my SD card ran out of space the first go around. So we're coming back. Where we left off, you had just talked about Brian Bell and then finding Cass and the Everyone's Agnostic podcast. So how did you end up getting involved, going from just hearing about the show to becoming co-host?
Well, I think it started because I loved the show so much and was really starting to get interested in talking about my experiences. And so I was terrified, but reached out and asked if they'd have me on their show. Like, a good part of me thought, oh no, why would they wouldn't want me on their show. I was like, no way, there's no way. But he did. And so he invited me on and I was like terrified the whole interview. I was shaking. I don't know if people could hear it. but I was so scared. But at the end, it was just very cathartic to talk to people who got it for the mm-hmm. first time. I didn't have a community like that who understood me. And I just felt so heard and validated. And so I just became very passionate about the show and the benefits that it gives to other people by hearing other stories and allowing you to develop language for the other kinds of experiences that you had in religion, but you couldn't put words on. And then in early 2017, I became non-monogamous. I became polyamorous. My marriage became non-monogamous. And so I reached out to Cass again on Everyone's Agnostic. And I'm like, you know, some stuff has changed for yeah. me. Would you be interested in interviewing me again as like a follow-up interview? Because I'm dating like multiple people now. Would you like to hear about that? And he was like, yes. And so he had me on as a guest for the second time. And that was super fun to talk about. And then Bob Pondillo, who was the co-host, ended up moving away from Nashville. And so it was just Cass on the show. And I saw an opportunity because I was getting really excited mm-hmm. about the catharsis and the good feelings that I get when I talk about my life and my experiences. And so I reached out to Cass and I first said, you know, I can help you with administrative stuff. Take that off your shoulders, reach out, schedule interviews, that do that whole thing, help you publish them. So it started out just as administrative support mm-hmm. for a few months. And then I was like, you know, I wouldn't mind being a co-host too, if you'd like it. And he was like, well, I don't really need one, but if you want to, sure.
Yeah.
So nice. So then he invited me on and I was a co-host for a full year before he decided to end the show. And then I started Everyone's Autonomous because I wasn't done talking
yeah.
yet.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's kind of how a big part of how this show started was
I
being a guest on Chariots of Iron back in 2010 and had way more prepared than they thought possible. So it took 3 episodes to get through the outline I had prepared.
Oh my god.
And then they brought me back a couple more times as a to fill in as a co-host, and then when that podcast ended I felt the need to replace it.
Cool.
And did.
Yeah, yeah, no, that sounds very similar to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just nice now that because we can brand it ourselves, we can mm-hmm. inject more of ourselves and our personality into it.
Yeah, yeah, and with Cass, you know, I know from when you reached out to me to book him on Atheist Nomads in that interview that he very much had a show for helping people kind of in that range from kind of late stage doubting, but still religious on into, you know, the baby atheist phase.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really important role. Where do
yes.
you see your show fitting with that?
I hadn't really thought about who my demographic is in terms of like, are they doubting or have they been doubting for a while or are they atheist? I think perhaps my demographic is perhaps people who are needing encouragement to not only work on their recovery from religion, but also to find that expansiveness that's available in terms of getting involved in the earth. And when I mean that, I just mean like the happenings of mm-hmm. the world around us, because we were so disconnected and disembodied from it before, and really were raised with a lot of narcissism for a lot of reasons. Like the white people like myself were raised with a lot of racial narcissism, class narcissism. Basically, I'm just trying to tear down a lot of that narcissistic kind of stuff. That just because you leave behind Christianity, which is a religious narcissism, doesn't mean that you've departed from everything else that is that prioritizes a particular kind of identity that you have. And so my goal is to say, okay, you did one. You deconstructed one social construct, mm-hmm. and now you are ready for more. So let's keep on pulling this apart and find the freedom that's available once you realize that this is all just kind of a chaotic joke, and that we don't know why we're here, but it naturally occurs to me that I would just want to make as many people as well as I possibly can while I'm on this earth.
Yeah.
And we should do that at the government level. We should do that at the interpersonal level. And so I'm trying to capture them from the very beginning to the very like long range arc where they're getting involved in the planet and they're giving back. They're healed up enough to give back and to find meaning in community and in humanity and in existence just because it exists.
Nice. So both the exposing people's residual bullshit they have and how to move past that.
Yeah.
Very nice. And then before we wrap up, one mm-hmm. thing we talked about a fair amount in your story that I tangentially had some experience with was with those missionary schools and schools of evangelism, and you'll find all kinds of names for them depending on what church they're associated with, if they're even associated really with a formal denomination.
Mm.
The ones I saw in the Adventist Church were very anti-intellectual, which was something that you've mentioned as well. Was yours like that?
Very much so, yes.
So it was just about teaching you what to believe and how to teach other people to believe that.
Yeah. It's interesting because this reminds me of this book I'm reading. It's basically an intro to philosophy book. But in one section, it distinguishes the difference between philosophy and religion. Both philosophy and religion address the larger existential questions that people have and explore those. The difference, though, is that religion, in addition to evidence, also considers scripture and revelation as legitimate forms of evidence. And religion also values rational thinking and using reason, but only to a certain extent. It needs to stop at a certain extent. And so my Christianity allowed for some rational thinking, but there was definitely a limit. Like if you went too far, you couldn't go past a certain point. And so, yeah, in that way, it was anti-intellectual. I mean, you could go get your fucking, grad degree, but just as long as you didn't question certain parts of Christianity, then you'd be okay.
And then why did you go to a missionary school instead of, say, a theology program?
I think that's because I've always been more of an emotional person, and theology felt too cerebral, intellectual, and something that wouldn't help me connect with the everyday person. To go and try to talk about theology seemed dumb when religion, if God is real, it should be a very clear, visceral sense of his existence. I shouldn't need to study to know that it's true. And so I kind of dismissed that as a viable approach to all of that. Plus, I just didn't think I was very smart.
Okay. What's kind of funny is a lot of theology programs, like the one I did, cover how to do counseling and conduct funerals and weddings in respectful ways, and how to preach various types of sermons, including weddings and funerals. There was a lot of stuff in that program that had nothing to do with theology in a technical sense,
And we actually only had two classes that were true theology out of the entire course. Because theology, in a technical sense, is like right on that line between religion and philosophy, where it's very theoretical and abstract and not really anything that gets covered in an undergrad.
Yeah.
It's not even much that gets covered at the graduate level. That's usually, you know, doctorates that end up really getting into the core of the basically mind games that theology really is.
Exactly.
The mental gymnastics to that extent.
Huh. So that's interesting. Yeah. You got mostly practical education instead of just, I'm surprised by that.
Yeah, it was a very much a more of a practical program, and the master's degree is basically considered, which I didn't finish, Master of Divinity, that's considered a professional program, not, you know, an academic graduate program.
Yeah.
Because they teach you how to do a profession, and it's a lot more on how to do the job than just these abstracts or just Bible classes.
Right. Religious philosophy. Interesting. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah. But that's kind of an interesting contrast there, because what I saw with the schools of evangelism, which is what they had in the Adventist church, was they were pumping out pastors who were actually getting hired as pastors after maybe a year of training.
Oof.
Two at the most. Whereas the conventional program was 7 years of schooling plus a 2-year internship. And these guys were getting through in 2 years and taking over churches. And it seemed like it was like they were actively trying to dumb down the church. Did you get a feel of anything like that in kind of the denomination you were in? Or around?
No, I hadn't really noticed that. In fact, like you articulating that is kind of like an aha, like, that essentially was what we were doing, but I wasn't aware that the education that we got was not education. It was just sensationalism and emotional manipulation, which is dumbing people down and abusing their fear, abusing their insecurity and real challenges that they have in their life. Wow. We didn't. I did not contribute good things to the planet by doing that.
Yeah.
Nope. Ooh.
Yeah. All right. Well, hopefully you don't have to work through that now.
No, I already knew it wasn't great. I just hadn't realized in that particular way how it was not great.
All right. Well, if people want to find you, where can they find you?
Yeah, so there's three major things that I'm involved in right now that people can find me and look up what I'm doing. One of them is the podcast, Everyone's Autonomous, and people can find information about that at everyonesautonomous.com, where I'm also on all the major platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter in regards to that. The second thing that I'm involved in is my coaching work for people who are recovering from from toxic religion, as well as people who are exploring or involved in a form of ethical non-monogamy. So people can find out more about that at mariedelefant.com. And that's just Marie, the letter D as in dog, and then the word elephant, because apparently that's my last name. Okay. So they can find that out, find information about the coaching there. And then lastly, the other thing that I do is my photography company is a humanist photography company. I'm doing a lot of volunteer work for the protests in Minneapolis and documenting that work and providing images for free to the activists and organizers. And I'm posting about that a lot with information about the protests. And so people can find out about that at marqueephoto.com. And that's spelled M as in Marie, A-R. K as in Keith, E-I. So marqueephoto.com. That's
right.
a hard one to try to like articulate. Like,
links will be in the show notes.
Yeah, thank you so much for that.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining me twice now.
It's all good. Thank you so much for having me. It's been really a delight.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview, and that wraps it up for this week. So remember, not all those who wander are lost.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. Theme music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.